You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
English speakers are a diverse and thorny group. For the last 500 years, they've been arguing and dressing down each other about the grammar, usage, and semantics of proper English. And now Amon Shea has written a book called Bad English that's intended to settle at least some of those controversies, but probably will create a few new ones. It's published by the Penguin Group. Amon Shea was here in June, and because language and grammar are such popular topics with our listeners, we are re-airing that interview for you today. I would say I'm very pleased to see you again, Amon, but I'm afraid that you would feel compelled to correct me. And so, a warm welcome.
Yeah. No, thank you. Yeah, very pleased was frowned on the basis that very as an adjective should not precede pleased as a past participle adjective. And so, it was considered at one point proper to say very much pleased, but that's largely fallen by the wayside.
I can't imagine anyone saying that now right. Who isn't from Britain.
It was thought to be an Americanism, which is one of the other things. The British love to try to keep some sort of hold over the language.
How crazy do some people get about the topic of proper English?
Well, quite a bit. It's easy to see how unhinged people can be about this. If we look back just 50 or 100 years ago, and there were language writers at the beginning of the 20th century insisting, for instance, that the word dilapidated should only be used to describe a stone building because, as anybody knows, lapis is the root of dilapidated, and lapis is Latin for stone. Therefore, only a fool would refer to a wooden structure as dilapidated. But we look back at that now and we say, well, that's just absurd, of course. Any kind of building can be dilapidated. But we still have a lot of similar kind of shibboleths around today.
Words like decimate, right. Which many people have also just allowed to be used for less than, 100 people?
Well, the reasoning behind decimate is that it ostensibly comes from a Latin military or Roman military punishment, meaning to kill one of every 10. And so it should still mean that. Somehow, we don't hold that standard to words like ovation, which came from a Latin military term meaning to give a small round of applause to somebody rather than a large one. But the problem with decimate is also that's a great example of how unhinged we are today. The first use of decimation, for instance, in English refers to tithing. So there's no punishment or destroying anything except for your checkbook. So beginning in the middle of the 16th century, it referred to tithing to the church. And then later it started to mean something about a military punishment.
I'm wondering about what kinds of emails I can expect in response to this segment and how many of them will be written in correct English.
Well, there is no such thing as correct English, so it's a little bit problematic to assume that we can ever achieve it.
Since they will be sent to me usually by email, has the Internet enriched the language, or do you think it's eroded it?
I don't know if I would say either. It's changed it. And I don't know that it's really necessary for us to say that any one thing can make something, our language, better or worse. It is in a state of flux.
Well, you sound like one of those permissive language people.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
France has the Académie Française to protect the purity of the French language and arbitrate disputes. Is English unique among languages in terms of just a continued debate over what's proper English?
I can't speak for the French, and I'm sure that there are many other languages that like to try to adhere to some set of rules to preserve it. These rules are generally quite ineffective. But English does, we do seem to have a healthy segment of the population that likes to worry about it.
Now, the French often argue over whether you should allow English words into the French language, like weekend, vacant,
right.
Whereas English seems to welcome foreign words.
We do.
We recognize that we have no English equivalent to Zeitgeist or Schadenfreude or
sure.
Garage, for that matter.
Right. We've always taken in words from a wide variety of sources, and I think it's really strengthened the language and made it much more interesting.
You begin the book with 9 examples of words that have become unmoored from their original meaning. Which one of them is the most egregiously used?
Well, I would not myself say that it's egregiously used because I think that has a kind of a pejorative connotation. I think the one that people seem to become most upset about is unique, used in a fashion which does not denote singularity.
People say it's the most unique thing I've ever
right.
seen.
That's more unique, or that's almost unique, or that's somewhat unique. Now, people have been doing this for hundreds of years now. And one of the things that the reason why people become upset about this is that unique is ostensibly an absolute adjective, an adjective that will not permit any state of variation. There are plenty of other adjectives in English that are supposed to be absolute. You know, the theory is that the word is either pregnant or it's not. You can either be unique or not unique. There's nothing in between, except that there previously were thought to be hundreds of these absolute adjectives in English.
Well, unique means one of a kind. So can it be anything but one of a kind?
Well, yes, it can.
I'm one of those purists.
Well, I am of the school that unique means what people intend it to mean. And so if you have millions and millions of people who use unique to mean special, then the language is going to reflect that and it will be used in that way.
One of the words that used to get people very upset was hopefully. Mm-hmm. When I first started doing the show, it was a common complaint during right. language segments. I don't hear it much anymore. Has that been resolved?
Not quite. The Associated Press did tweet, of all things, their new stance on this in 2012, in which they said, "We now support the modern usage of hopefully," which is, most people would say, it simply means it is to be hoped. That's what people mean when they use it.
It's a lot more words.
It is a lot more words to say it is to be hoped. But I think hopefully has largely faded from view as a peeve. Most people feel entirely comfortable using hopefully as a sentence adverb.
The same people who objected to hopefully didn't object to happily, did they?
No, they didn't object.
Is that
certainly.
The same thing?
Surely. Sure. It's a sentence
surely?
Adverb. Well, you know, it's an adverb that modifies a sentence rather than a specific word.
Well, I could never hear the word surely without thinking of the film Airplane.
Airplane, don't call me Shirley. Right, of course.
Surely, yeah. Yes.
Right. Yeah, that's one of my favorite examples of a sentence adverb. I think there are some people who still object to hopefully and still hold on to the notion that one must say it is to be hoped.
Didn't the Associated Press announce in 2012 that they supported the modern usage of hopefully?
Yes.
What was the reaction to that?
The Washington Post had an article that said the barbarians have finally done it, or some kind of hyperbolic language. A lot of people were quite upset about it, but a lot of people, as you know, is not surprising, unsurprisingly, one might say, a lot of people really didn't understand what the fuss was all about because the language has changed in that way.
You mentioned that there are any number of words that are thought to be singular along with unique. What are some of the other ones? Have they caused similar problems?
Well, not so much. There are a number that were commonly thought of in this way in the 19th century that are just kind of inexplicable to us now. For instance, sober and invariable and flat, and dry, wet. Something is either dry or it's not dry. And you know, but mostly these have really faded from view. We do see them occasionally, for instance.
We can't say very dry?
Well, you can say very dry now.
It has very dry wit.
Right. You could say that. Well, they were speaking of dry as in something is either dry or wet. But yeah, that was something, you know, that it would be by some people 150 years ago considered to be questionable. Perfect is a fine example of a word that can either be pregnant or not, because something is obviously either perfect or it is not. But we've also been using this in a varied way for hundreds of years.
It could be perfectly unique.
Right. Perfect. Almost perfectly unique.
When President Obama used the word enormity in a speech, many thought it was incorrect.
Sure.
What was the context and what was the reaction?
He was speaking of the enormity of the task that lies before us, and this was in 2011. He used it twice in that way. And the quibble with this is that enormity should properly be used to mean great evil rather than great size. And what is often suggested as a substitute is enormousness. If you want to speak of the enormousness of the task that lies before us, that's fine. This overlooks, however, the fact that for the first 200 years that enormousness existed in English, it meant great wickedness. The same thing when enormous first came into the English language, it meant great, greatly wicked or just somehow wrong. So it's questionable to me why that we should allow certain of these words to change meaning, and yet somehow we plant our flag in the ground and say enormity must not change.
What about less and few? They describe different things, and yet we're allowing the word less to take over and the word few to disappear.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I don't think that we can allow or disallow anything. We don't have any no one person has the control over the language, much as we would like that to be the case. Language is a living, breathing, it's an inexorable force.
Well, somebody other than I is doing that.
Okay. Less and few have been used interchangeably since, I believe, about 800, and somehow Western civilization has not yet fallen off the precipice. I think generally one understands when one hears less or few or whatever the case may be. I don't know that anything, any degree of specificity is lost there.
My guest is the author of a new book called Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation, Amon Shay, who is also the author of Reading the OED, which brought you here,
yes,
I think, some time in the past. Another word that gets a lot of people upset is disinterest, used to mean uninterested.
Sure. That's a fine example as well, because disinterested was first used in 1929, I believe, and uninterested was first used in 1629, and uninterested first came up in 1631. The feeling among people who like to stay up at night worrying about the language is that disinterested should be impartial. You have a disinterested judge, and that uninterested should be bored. For instance, you probably have an uninterested teenager at home. However, when the words first entered the language, they meant the opposite. So the first meaning of disinterested, the first way in which it was used, was to mean bored. And the first meaning of uninterested was to mean impartial. And somewhere along the way, they swapped. We're not sure why, but just enough people decided to use them the other way that it happened.
Sometimes words take on the opposite meaning from their original intent, like fulsome.
Right. So that's a word that's called an autonym or an autoantonym, where a word can mean itself and its antonym simultaneously.
How do words typically enter the English language? Did Shakespeare invent them all?
No. He invented many of them, but far fewer than it is generally thought. He invented hundreds of words rather than thousands of words. Sometimes he just made them up, and it was for reasons of he needed to have an extra syllable in a word, and he would throw an extra thing in there.
And we understand them in context. And other ones, I'm assuming, were already in use, but he's the first one to have written them down.
We paid much more attention to Shakespeare than we've paid to, say, the average copy editor in 1604, so we have more of his language preserved.
Are words created in response to a need? For example, I mentioned Zeitgeist and Schadenfreude, which have been borrowed from the German because they describe something that we don't have an English word
for. Sure, they are occasionally. Scofflaw is a great example in that there was a contest in 1934 run by a man named Delsevier King who wanted a word for somebody who did not observe the 18th Amendment to the Constitution, who didn't observe prohibition. And so he had an advertised contest in a newspaper, and a bunch of people sent in suggestions, and Scofflaw was the winning entry. Of course, very soon after that, we had no more need for someone who didn't observe the 18th Amendment since prohibition ended, and now Scofflaw just stuck around like an unwanted party guest.
Do you think that some of the internet expressions like LOL or OMG will stick around?
Well, absolutely. Well, first of all, OMG dates from 1917. It's a little bit older than the internet. The first recorded use of OMG is found in a wonderful letter that's in the Oxford English Dictionary, and it was, I hear that a new order of knighthood is on the tapis, OMG, oh my God, shower on the Admiralty. And it was a letter written from the man in charge of the British Navy, and he was writing to Winston Churchill. So they were not really teenagers or internet, tweeters or anything. And it's been around for, almost 100 years now. LOL is pretty new. It dates from 1989. I think there's a good chance it'll stick around because it does fulfill a need. One of the things that I find objectionable about people who carp about language, and this is not everybody who cares about it, but we frequently, we fall much more easily into complaining about language than celebrating it. And a common complaint is that people say, well, if we stop using a word to mean this, something will be lost in the language. That's debatable, but we never celebrate something new being given to the language.
Well, there are also generational issues.
Oh, absolutely.
So when kids say, my bad, Joan Rivers has, who's going to be on the show later, really gets upset by that kind of thing. And
sure.
to be honest, I would never say it.
I typically do not say my bad, but there are very clear generational things. But one of the things that's surprising about them is that you can typically find similar ones from several generations ago. For instance, many of your listeners perhaps dislike hearing sentences begun with the word like so-and-so, so-and-so.
Sentences where like is every third word.
Oh, that's true. But I'm willing to bet that many of them have no trouble beginning sentences with the word well. And in 1909, a little usage guide called Write It Right, written by Ambrose Bierce, referred to well as a mere meaningless prelude to a sentence. So the difference between well and like is that your grandparents say well and your grandchildren say like, but functionally they do the same exact thing.
Doesn't well also kind of mean on the other hand, or how do you explain? Doctors today, in fact, many people in the sciences, begin their sentences with the word so, mm-hmm. which has really upset many of my listeners.
It has. Many of these words, Phil, have many functions. For instance, like has a lot of different things that it can do. And well can function in that way, but it can also function just as it was referred to as a mere meaningless prelude to a sentence. Nothing is really meaningless. It's filling some role, though.
We say
Sure.
We say things like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
All fillers, of those filler things words, are fillers.
Sure. Right.
And they drive some people crazy. Mm-hmm. Others have no other option. They just sprinkle their sentences.
Well, the new ones tend to drive people crazy. And the old ones tend to, like I said, have been kind of smoothed down around the edges.
What's the problem with the word belittle?
Thomas Jefferson coined that word in his notes on the state of Virginia in 1782. And a number of British reviewers really didn't like it. They wrote, oh, spare us, we beseech you, spare our mother tongue, in really hyperbolic, ridiculous language. I think it was more that they had a problem with Thomas Jefferson than they had a problem with belittle.
Belittle is a perfectly useful word.
Well, it is now, but it is, as far, you know, as recent as 1926, Henry Fowler was still referring to it as an undesirable alien.
Then there was controversy over the word balding, although that seems to me to describe right. a process that many, many men go through, and some women as well.
The theory behind balding, and this was common in the mid-20th century, was that you're not actually seeing somebody go bald, so you should use the word baldish rather than balding.
Ooh, baldish sounds
baldish
terrible.
Really never caught on, did it?
It sounds more like balderdash. One of the things that many people object to is making nouns into verbs.
Sure. That really bothers a lot of people.
And that's also a very old process?
It's about as old as the English language, so over 1,000 years old. I mean, it is almost impossible to think of any sentence without coming up with examples. Sentence is a fine example. Sentence functions as a verb. Sentence functions as a noun. We don't think twice about it.
We're calling it verbing, but spell check doesn't recognize the word.
Well, I guess it's a little bit more of a jargon term. But nouns frequently become verbs, and verbs frequently become nouns. It's part of the way that I think all languages work.
One of the words that many people object to in that regard is impact.
Right. Impact has been getting under people's skin for some while. The theory is that impact functions very nicely as a noun, therefore we should just leave well enough alone and not try to use it as a verb. This conveniently overlooks the fact that it has been used as a verb and as a transitive verb for about 200 years longer than it's been a noun. So if we want to give...
Impact was a verb first?
Yeah, it started being used as a verb. The first case is in 1601. And it generally referred to something having to do with the bowels, and we'll leave the details out of it. But it's been a verb for about two centuries longer than it's been a noun.
When I first started doing the show, a listener called in to complain that I used the word none in both the singular and the plural.
Right.
And then another listener called in and said, oh, I think that has been the case since the year 900.
Yes.
That is, but it does come from no one originally.
True, but our language manages to work in somewhat illogical fashion quite often.
Are there categories of bad English? What's the difference between grammatical errors and errors in usage?
Well, errors of usage typically refer to a word being given a meaning which it is thought to not have. For instance, unique or enormity are considered to be errors of usage. And I is considered correct grammar. It is me is considered a problem with grammar because do not have the nominative case.
But as Pat O'Connor has pointed out, it should be woe is I.
Right.
And yet Shakespeare said woe is me.
Right.
That's the way it is.
Well, Shakespeare was very good at butchering these things frequently.
There's the whole issue of ending a sentence in a preposition. Has that been put to rest along with split infinitives?
One would think so. It should have been, because for the past 120 years, pretty much every single usage guide that has looked into this has said there is nothing wrong with ending a sentence with a preposition.
Why did that come up as a problem in the first place?
It was all the fault of a man named Joshua Poole, who was a minor grammarian who in 1646 decided he didn't like it. The poet John Dryden came across this in his work, and John Dryden decided he didn't like it, and he so much didn't like it, Dryden, that he republished a book of his own poems 16 years after it first came out, mainly so he could take his prepositions and move them up, and it kind of snowballed from there, and people just decided that it was improper.
And then the split infinitive is because there was an attempt to apply the rules of Latin to English, even though we don't have infinitive words.
Right.
What about apostrophes? Now, apostrophes seem to be a major problem for people under a certain age. So many of them spell it's IT apostrophe S when it should not have that apostrophe.
Well,
and then when it should have that apostrophe, they don't use it.
Apostrophes have been problems. There's this notion that we used to have a kind of firm grip on apostrophes, and then these darn kids came along and they've been ruining it ever since. We've never had a firm grasp on what an apostrophe should do. An example of this is that Thomas Jefferson and Jane Austen were writing it's, IT apostrophe S, for the possessive case of it in the late 18th century. We've been changing the rules with apostrophes constantly, and we're still changing them. 50 years ago, the department store Harrods had an apostrophe at the end of it between the D and the S, and now it doesn't. It's just magically disappeared. So the rules keep on changing.
I've seen many homes where there's a sign that says something like the Smiths with an apostrophe.
There are seemingly an infinite number of variations on how one can apply the apostrophe.
And then there's the apostrophe, the word that ends with an S. Do you just put an apostrophe at the end when you're doing a possessive, or do you do an apostrophe S?
It depends, and it depends on what way you're using the word. And it's a tricky subject at best.
Many people talk about English as being the official language of the United States, and an educator recently, I think it was in Arizona, got into trouble for saying we should eliminate Spanish totally. He spelled Spanish, by the way, with a lowercase s, but he spelled English with a capital E.
Yeah. English is not now, nor has it ever been, the official language of the United States. It is by far the most common language in the United States, but we do not have an official language.
Was there ever a movement to fix the English language in the United States?
Yeah, there have been a number of them, especially at the beginning of the 19th, end of the 18th century. There were some movements. Noah Webster took part in it for a while.
Well, he purposely set out to distinguish American English and American spelling from British spelling.
Sure.
And then the British did the same thing on their side of the Atlantic afterward.
He had a bit of a partisan approach to the English language. And most of his and he did actually change a lot more spelling things than any of us ever will. But we should just be thankful, I think, that many of his suggested reforms, such as spelling prove, P-R-O-O-V, never actually stuck. But he did have a very firm idea on distinguishing American spelling from British.
Didn't Theodore Roosevelt try to impose an executive decree regarding language?
He didn't try. He did issue it an executive decree in which he unilaterally changed 300 spellings of 300 words.
Did the House of Representatives immediately sue him for that?
They took a couple of months to mock him first and tease them about it. He wanted to spell words like kissed, K-I-S-T, and things along those lines. He wanted to spell machine, M-I-C-H-E-E-N. They overturned his decree after a few weeks.
Well, George Bernard Shaw also tried to change spelling and pointed out that fish could be spelt G-H-O-T-I.
Right.
But people thought that he was just joking around.
Yeah. Well, he actually left money in his will, I think a not inconsiderable amount of money, to for somebody to create something called Shavian.
Well, it sounds to me like, and I just started that word with well, it sounds to me like you are not one of those people who thinks that English is in a continual state of progressive degradation.
No,
but
we've been hearing that for hundreds of years now. And I think that, you know, if we were going to go to hell in a handbasket, we would have got there by now. Or maybe just this handbasket is not actually moving.
Mm-hmm. And hell in a handbasket is a wonderful phrase. Do we know who created it?
I do not.
Well,
you can always say Shakespeare.
Well, we can always say Shakespeare for everything. Right. The OED is kind of is responsible for Shakespeare getting so much credit, even when he didn't deserve it all.
It's in large part the OED being misinterpreted. They try to give the first use of a word, and frequently it tends to be Shakespeare in their records, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he was the first to use. It means he was the first to record, be recorded using a word.
Amon Shea's latest book, oh, by the way, he has contributed to the On Language column, Sunday's New York Times, reviewed language books for the New York Times Book Review. His latest book is Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. It is published by Perigee, which is a division of the Penguin Group. And I thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me.